всем. The Gospel according to John, chapter 21, verses 15-17, describes the conversation between Jesus and Peter after Jesus' resurrection and their his last meeting with his friends and disciples. And you have a text in front of you. So three times Jesus asks Peter whether he loves him. Three times Peter gives a positive answer. Three times after getting Peter's answer, Jesus asks him to take care of his flock. Do you have the handout, all of you?
I think we need three more.
Three more. Can I just leave?
Just
give
me a bunch.
Yeah. Uh-huh. So and then you'll just watch it. A literary device John used in this dialogue is the three folded structure. The same situation is repeated three times. We all are well aware of this literary device. We remember it from our favorite childhood reading, the fairy tales. We learned by heart since then that in order to reach the desired, a main hero of a story had to repeat his deeds three times, and only after the third time his dreams come true. This literary device was actively used in other genres as well. We find it in Lives of Saints, for instance, or in epic literature. No matter who, when, and where use this device, its function is always the same: to emphasize the importance of the action described. Hence, John's use of the three-folded structure has to immediately attract our attention to the dialogue. That's the whole reason for why he repeats his questions three times. If we turn to the Greek original of the Gospel, according to John, we find out that the situation is much more complex. While repeating Jesus' questions and Peter's answers, John used a whole variety of synonyms, that is, words with a similar but not the same meaning. Why did he do it? Did he do it just for stylistic purposes? And by using different words with similar meaning, John merely wanted to embellish his prose? Or did he deliberately choose his words? If so, if his choice of words was deliberate, then our task is to try to understand what he wanted to say to his readers. We shall start with the most plausible pair of synonyms. "Feed my lambs," or sheep, said Jesus to Peter, and repeated his request three times. In all three times, Jesus, this way or another, rephrased his request. Bosca ta arniamu, verse 15. Pimene ta probatiamu, verse 16. Bosca ta probatamu, verse 17. The verb bosco means to feed, to nourish, hence metaphorically to take care, to support. The noun to arnia is the diminutive of arin, ram. Hence, to arnion is a little lamb. This word is used in the Gospels only by John, but his use of it comes for first and foremost, Revelation chapter 5, verses 6, 8, 12, chapter 6, verses 1, 16, 7, verses 9, 10, 14, 17, etc., shows that to arnio meant for him an image of Christ. Let us read Revelation chapter 5, verse 6. "And I beheld, and lo, in the midst of the throne, and the four living beings, and in the midst of the elders stood a lamb, Tornim, as it had been slain, having seven horns and seven eyes, which are the seven spirits of God, sent forth unto all the earth. Little lambs of verse 15 are those who, like Christ, will sacrifice themselves for the sake of mankind. These are his apostles. The word to probatium of verse 16 is a very interesting case. First, it's the diminutive of the word to probaton used in the verse 17. Its meaning is transparent, little sheep. The problem is, first, that to probatin is an extremely rare word. In the entire New Testament, it's used only once and only in this particular case. The search in the Thesaurus Lingua Graeca, that's today the most representative database of classical and Byzantine Greek, and it today, at present moment, it contains about 18 million words. The search in this database provides only 109 hits. So it's extremely rare word. You do realize, yeah? Now, even more problematic is the fact that only few versions of the early versions of New Testament has this reading. But these versions of New Testament are extremely important for the history of the New Testament, of the Gospels. So it is, I mean, most scholars believe that it's what John indeed used, this word he did use. Because in other texts, in quite a lot of early texts, instead of probation, we read probaton. But still, let's believe that he used here to probation, that is, little sheep. If you look at the examples I provided you with, you will notice that in most cases, the word to probaton is used together with the word pimano and its derivatives, derivative opimin, pimenos, which means, the word pimena means to herd, to guide, to govern, and pimin, pimenos, means a herdsman, hence, metaphorically, a shepherd, pastor, teacher, leader, etc. The fact that John puts two words together in one sentence, that is the pimena and probaton, immediately brings to mind two most important contexts. One is Old Testament context, and namely the line from Prophet Zechariah chapter 13, verse 7. Pataxita tus pimenas, ke expasita ta probata, smite the shepherds and draw out the sheep. And on the other hand, the New Testament ideas, that is the idea of relationship between shepherd and sheep, the the lost and found sheep, whom the shepherd brings back to light, to life, on his shoulder, and who recognize his voice. And this theme is extremely important precisely for John, and he dedicated to it his entire, practically the most of his entire chapter 10, and you have examples. Hence, we can propose that Jesus asks Peter to guide his Jesus followers, those whom he found, brought back on his shoulders, and perhaps John's used the fact that John used the diminutive here, and once again, it's an extremely rare word. Perhaps he did it in order to express Christ's tender love toward his followers. Finally, in verse 17, Jesus once again repeats the verb bosko, to feed, to nourish, to take care, to support, and uses the word dobrobytan. Dobrobytan is the general term for all footed animals. Hence, as the development of this general meaning, it's the animals for sacrifice. But also it has a metaphorical meaning. Metaphorically, it means simple, naive, unexperienced, ignorant, lazy, dull people. Jesus asks Peter to take care of all the people. To sum up, according to John's verses 15-17, Jesus first asks Peter to take care, physically and metaphysically, of those who will sacrifice themselves for his sake, for the sake of his of the new teaching, the apostles, his little lambs. He then asks Peter to guide his followers, his little sheep, who, because of fear and lack of leadership, might be dispersed. Finally, he asks him to take care of all mankind, of those ignorant, naive, lazy, and dull people, his sheep, who do not know the truth yet. The second pair of synonyms is used by John in verse 17. Upset by Jesus asking him for a third time whether he loves him, Peter answers, "Lord, thou knowest all things. Thou knowest that I love thee." The Greek original reads as follows: Kyrie, panta si odas, si idas, I'm sorry, si ginoskis, oti philose. Once again, we observe that John deliberately collides words that have similar but slightly different meanings. In his first and second answers, Peter used the expression si idas. Idas is the form of the verb ido. In his third answer, Peter used this verb and its synonym, ginoskis, present tense of the verb gignosko. What is the difference between the two? The verb ido expresses the idea of a complete intuitive knowledge, the spiritual ability to penetrate the essence of things through the mind eye. It's the ability of the psychic self. The verb gignoska describes the knowledge acquired through the experience. That is, it means to learn things. The same collision of meanings John used two more times. In chapter 8, verse 15, "Yet you have not known him, agnokata. You have not yet learned about him. But I know him, ida. I see him through my mind eye. And if I should say, I know him not, I do not see him, I shall be alive like unto you, but I know I see him and keep his saying." You understand? And in chapter 13, verse 7, Jesus answered and said unto him, "What I do, thou knowest not now, you do not see it, but thou shalt know, gnosi, learn hereafter." So he plays on two different meanings of the synonyms: to see, to be able to penetrate, and to know, to get, to acquire the knowledge through experience. Thus, in his third answer, Peter refers to both natures of Jesus Christ. He says to Jesus, "As God, you are able to see everything, and as a man, through your own human experience, you know, you learn that I love you." And now, when they realized that John's use of synonyms is not a mere stylistic device in order to keep his reader entertained, but a careful and deliberate choice, we can turn to the most difficult pair of synonyms he used, verbs agapao and phileo. Let us one more time examine the passage. Twice Jesus asked Peter, "Agapas me?" Peter persistently answers, "Philosa." Only in third time, Jesus rephrases his question and uses Peter's word, "Philisme," upset by Jesus asking him for a third time, Philisme, Peter answers, "You see everything. You know that, Philosa." What did John wanted to say? The use of word agapao and phileo in this particular phrase, passage, attracted attention of many, many theologians, linguists, and interpreters of the whole of it years and years ago. Some have argued that John used verbs agapao and phileo as synonyms, with no real significant difference in their meanings. They further allege that there is no semantic distinction between the two verbs, and that the author has used them for stylistic purposes only. Yet other scholars do argue for a distinction, precisely and especially in this particular conversation between Jesus and Peter. Let us examine these scholars' opinions in details. Some scholars who believe in the distinction of these two verbs, some scholars understand agapao as a love of intelligence, reason, and comprehension, as a love of people united by mutual ideas. From that point of view, agapao far surpasses phileo, that is understood as a love of mere personal affection or liking, where no intelligence or high purpose is involved. They believe that agapao in the Gospels generally indicates love deep-seated, thoroughgoing, intelligent, and purposeful, a love in which the entire personality, not only emotions, but also, more importantly, mind and the will, plays a prominent role. Phileo, on the contrary, indicates this spontaneous natural affection, which is based first and foremost on emotions. Hence, agapao expresses a higher type of love that is more intellectual rather than emotional, while phileo signifies a lower type of love which often lacks or minimizes the intellect or the will. The others see the situation as absolutely different. They hold phileo to be higher type of love than agapao. Studying the classical Greek, they conclude that agapao lacks the idea of warmth and fondness conveyed in phileo. The reason for such debates is that the context of the Gospels simply does not allow us to detect the difference between these two verbs. Indeed, both verbs can be used to express, for instance, father's love toward his son. Father loved the son, John chapter 3, verse 35, agapao. But father loved the son, John 5, verse 20, phileo. Or son's love toward his friends, Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. John 11, verse 5, agapao, and John 11, verse 36, phileo. And toward favorite disciples, Jesus' favorite disciple, John 13, chapter verse 23, chapter 21, verse 7, 20, agapao, and John 20, verse 2, phileo. Like phileo, agapao also describes affectionate love. Apostle Paul teaches husbands to love their wives. You have examples in your handout. Emotional is the love of Jesus towards Martha, Mary, and Lazarus. His love toward people and his love toward his favorite disciple. No less emotional is Abraham's love toward his son Isaac, or Isaac's love towards his wife Rebecca, Samson's love toward Delilah, or husband's love toward his wife. You have examples. In all these cases, we have the word agapao. Agapao can go from heart, from soul, or from mind. Thou shalt love the Lord thy God with all thy heart, and with all thy soul, and with all thy mind, says Matthew, and also Mark, and also Luke. In other words, The context of the Old and New Testaments show that the verbs agapao and philia were used interchangeably, and we cannot determine, on the basis of their context, what was the difference between the two verbs. The only thing we can say for sure is that the verb agapao was used more frequently than the verb phileo in the New Testament. Agapao is used 142 times and phileo 25 times. Is there any evidence that allows us to understand the difference between these verbs? I think there is. But in order to find it, we have to turn not to the context of these verbs, but to their grammatical characteristics. Let me remind you that Greek has seven tenses. More importantly is that while using tenses, the Greek language pays attention to both notions, the time of the action and the type of the action. Thus, we have Greek has present, it's a continuous type of continuous kind of action, aorist, a one-time action fully accomplished in the past, or it's finished past, imperfect, a continual or repetitive action in the past or unfinished past, perfect, a past action which continues as a state in the present, it's continuous past, pluperfect, a past action which continues as a state in the past, or it's the past before another past, future one, an action that will be fully completed in the nearest future, it's a limited future, and finally, future free or future perfect, a future action that continues as a state in another more distant future. It's the future after the future. You have it. In short, all tenses can be divided into two big categories. Tenses describing fully accomplished actions, either in the past or in the future, and tenses describing non-accomplished actions, present, imperfect, perfect. Note that pluperfect and future free also describe non-accomplished actions, but these are very extremely rare tenses and practically do not use in the New Testament. Now let us look at the table you have it in your handout. We can see from the table that the word agapao, to love, can be used in all tenses without changing its meaning. Phileo, to love, meaning to love, can be used only in tenses that describe non-accomplished actions, the present tense, the continuous past, and the unfinished past. In short, it means to love only in those tenses that do not bear in themselves the idea of chronological limits. When phileo is used in the tenses that describe a fully accomplished action in the finished past or in the limited future, it changes its meaning radically. It does not mean to love anymore. It means now to kiss. Greeks also used the verb kataphileo, which means to caress, to cover with kisses, and can be used in all tenses. Now let us discuss the difference between these two verbs, kataphileo, to cover with kisses, and ephilisa, philisa, that is phileo in this particular meaning, with particular tenses when it changes its meaning. Kataphileo is usually used to describe peaceful, tender, gentle, and warm action. This action lacks any idea of passion, obsession, fervor, or ardor. In the Gospels, it is used to describe an action of Mary Magdalene, who washed Jesus' feet, dried them with her hair, and then covered them with tender little kisses. In the Acts, chapter 20, verse 37, when apostles realized that they will never see Paul again, weeping, they hugged him and covered him with kisses. Forms ephilissa or philissa, on the contrary, describe very passionate, explicit declaration of love. This is the kind of kiss a husband gives his wife during their first night. Or it's the kiss wives and mothers give to their beloved ones, sending them to war, without knowing whether they will see them again or not. All their love, all their fears, tenderness, passion, dreams, and all their hopes are in this last kiss. In the Gospels, these forms are used only 3 times. In Matthew, chapter 26, verse 46, in Mark, chapter 14, verse 44, and in Luke, chapter 22, verse 47. In all 3 cases, these forms describe an action of Judas. What Judas did is not just a mere kiss. He openly gave Jesus a token of his passionate love. This was a kiss that absolutely ignores public opinions, all these high brows, or these rolling eyes, or this wow. Absolutely not. This is the most sincere kiss, at least in the eyes of bystanders. So just visualize that for a second. I mean, what people could see. So they saw that one friend suddenly gave his friend, a token of his most sincere, most passionate love. Things which people do not do in public. But, I mean, who knows? Maybe he felt just a desire to express his sudden attack of love. And only 2 people, or these bystanders, know the truth. The one who gave the token of love and the one who was given the token of love. Only these 2 know that this is not the token of utmost love. It's the token of utmost lie. The depth of Jesus' betrayal, the level of his hypocrisy, is expressed in the Gospels with a minimum of artistic devices, by means of just one, but a very strong word. To sum up, the study of grammatical characteristics of 2 verbs shows that they indeed are different. The verb agapao describes love as an action that can begin and stop at any chronological point. The verb phileo describes love as a state. Once happened, it lasts forever. Semantic difference of synonyms usually becomes apparent only in the context in which these synonyms are deliberately collided. For instance, we can say the girl is pretty, we can say the girl is beautiful. It doesn't matter. Used separately, these words were playing on the similarity of these words rather than on their difference. But then we collide these 2 words. When we say she is not beautiful, but she is pretty, we are playing on the differences of 2 words. The same situation is here. So what John did, he deliberately collided the meaning of 2 similar but still different words. He played on their similarities, on their differences. What he was trying to say? Jesus asked Peter, "Do you love me?" using the neutral verb agapao. Peter chooses as a response the semantically marked verb that describes a love that has no time limits, striving thereby to emphasize the continuous and eternal nature of his love. "I love you forever," he answers, wishing to be sure that Peter's choice is conscious. Jesus asks his question a second time, using the same neutral word, do you love me? Peter repeats his answer, I love you forever, indefinitely. Now Jesus is absolutely sure that Peter's choice is mindful, and he rephrases his question. He finally uses the verb of Peter, the verb that, because of its grammatical characteristics, can be used only to express everlasting love. Accepting Peter's word, Jesus thus accepts Peter's declaration of his internal and unchanging love. I, as you understand, finish my presentation. Just I would like you us to open the first chapter of your handout, look at the text again, and try to interpret it for the last time. So they had their last dinner together, and Jesus asked, do you love me, Peter? And Peter answers, I love you indefinitely. I love you forever. Take care of my little lambs, of my apostles, of those who will willingly sacrifice themselves for the sake of me and my teaching. Do you love me, Peter? I love you forever. Take care of my little sheep, or those whom I bring back to life, those who now learn how to recognize my voice, govern, guide them, be a good shepherd to them. So you love me forever, Peter. And we have to realize how Peter must be upset. I mean, twice he told him that he loves him forever. But doesn't he pay attention to him? Doesn't he listen to him? Doesn't he trust him? And upset, and it's exactly what John tells us, upset he says, Lord, as God, you are able to see, as a human being, through your experience, through all this life, all these years together, you know that I love you forever. Take care of the entire mankind. Ask him, Jesus. It's how I read the text. Thank you. Questions?
Are there other examples in the New Testament where we see Jesus using either the word agapo or
phileo? Oh, yes. Yeah.
No. Yeah, and do they conform to your analysis here?
Well, it's the only time when these two verbs are put in the same context, it's only this John's reading. Right. But we find, as you know, I gave you examples, right. We have a number of cases when Jesus either used the word agapao or uses the word phileo, and actually it means the same, as I said.
But he's not bringing them together.
Never. That's the only what John did. Right. Mm-hmm. Never.
I have a question about the verb to know, and actually it's the Old Testament question. Which verb is used in the sentence that's translated, and Adam knew his wife?
Oh, that's a very good question. I can't answer. I have to check. I have to check.
It's Hebrew, but my question is how is it translated into Greek?
Yeah, but you know, exactly. that I simply can't.
I think it's the same verb as in John 13. Which I think is ginosko.
So just through the experience to learn.
And this
something.
Is eternal life to know God. So ginosko is
ginosko.
Is
okay. So just what you acquired through your experience.
So it's the experience.
Or this is eternal.
Yes, it's the well. Actually, we have to say that I mean ginosko. Actually, it's the human ability, and Ido. Actually, it's it's a little bit supernatural. It's what psychic can do. I mean, they can see things without, I mean, intuitive vision of phenomena.
Just comment that genossen in German, it's to know most.
Yes, but I mean, to know knowledge. It's exactly. It's the same.
Can
Yeah, it's the same Indo-European word. Yeah, yeah, so it's just, you know.
Maybe it's worth mentioning the august background of the difference between these two verbs, oida and also. In the parent language, Indo-European, from which Greek developed, there were two grand old verbs, to see and to know. And the to see verb became the seeing one, as you would. And the way it developed was to have seen. There's two kinds of stems in the verb. The past tense, I have seen and therefore I know. The have seen means I know in all the daughter languages.
You mean about the Ido and Gitnosko?
Yeah.
Yeah, yeah. Yeah.
It's in Russian, the
in Russian we have Vyadati.
Vyadati and Vyadis.
Yes.
In English we have wit, which is from seeing originally, which means know. And
we have what?
Wit. Wits, your knowledge and so on. And the other one is just basically know. The English word know, the Russian word znat, kognosko in Latin.
Yes.
It's deeply built into the difference between them, but these two verbs accompany each other all throughout the family, all throughout the...
What happened to the second future tense?
Why is it one and three?
Oh, it's a really good question. I don't know the answer. You know, it's the same. You know, I asked myself the same answer question. You know, if a few words, I didn't find the. The answer. I don't understand what happened to the future.
When I studied classics, we only did it as future one and future perfect. We never called it.
Well, maybe it's two different traditions. Yeah.
Yeah. So I don't think there is a future.
So, yeah,
it's
yeah.
Like reading or singing the canon. You go from one to three.
right.
But to put this in a liturgical context,
yes.
First of all, it's extremely important for everyone here to know that this is read every 11 weeks. That this is part of the collection of resurrection gospels that are read every Saturday night. There are 11 of them. This is the 11th, and in a way, it forms a kind of.